For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
It's April the 27th. We are continuing in Parshas Teruma, and we're on page 448. We're up to Pasuk Chaf Gimel. We're up to the Shulchan, the table. V'yasisa Shulchan atzei shitim, you shall make a table made of shitim wood. Amasayim arko, its length is 2 amos. V'ama rachbo, its width is 1 ama. V'ama mechetzi kamaso, and its height was 1 ama and a half. So this table is slightly smaller than the aron, than the ark. The ark was 2.5 by 1.5 by 1.5. This is 2 by 1 by 1.5. So it's not quite as long and not quite as wide. Vitzibisos, the height of 1.5 amos does not include the part where the lechem hapanim, where the shobet are going to go. It's only till the top of the table. Vitzibisos zahav tahar, you shall plate it with pure gold. You shall make for it a golden crown around it. So we've already had one golden crown that was around the aron, around the ark. We had a golden crown, I guess we'll call it a crown. And now we have another one that is around the table. Now, the crown of around the Aron represented the crown of Torah. Okay, so the crown around the table, around the Shulchan, represents which crown? Okay, so the crown around the table represents the crown of Malchus, of royalty. We know that there are 3 crowns. There is a Keser Malchus, and a Keser Torah, and a Keser Kahuna. So you got a crown of royalty, and a crown of Torah, and a crown of the priesthood of Kohuna, and this is the second one that we're accounting for. We've had the crown of Torah. Now we have the crown of royalty that's on the table, and the crown of Kohuna of the priesthood will be around which item? It'll be around the altar. Okay, so we'll get to that later. Now, why is it that a crown around a table represents royalty? Why a table?
A king usually takes care of everybody's needs and to make sure the people have what they need. And a table has a lechem hapanim, the bread, which you need to eat.
Okay. Okay, so a table represents food. Food is a materialistic thing. And the king's primary purpose is to, at least his primary physical purpose, is to maintain the material needs of his subjects, make sure they're taken care of, they have what to eat, they're protected from enemies, they have roads that are paved, whatever is necessary for the government to do, that is the king's responsibility. So the Shulchan is the Shulchan Malachim, it's the table of kings, and the crown represents royalty. So continuing now, Pasuk Chavhei verse 25, V'yasisom misgeres, you shall make for it a border. How do they translate it here?
A molding.
Okay. Misgeres comes from the word sagur, which means closed. It's a border. A border, tofach saviv, it is the height of a tefach, around it, a handbreadth, around the table. V'yasisom zer zahav l'miskarto saviv, and you shall make a golden crown around its misgeres, around its border. Rashi explains this is not a second crown, it's the same crown as before, but now the Torah is telling you where to put it. Where do you put this crown? The crown goes on the misgeres, on the border or the molding. There is a debate in the Gemara and the Talmud, where is this misgeres? Where does it go? Where does this border, this molding, where does it go? Some understand that the border goes on the rim of the table. So you have a flat table like we have in front of us, but there would be a rim jutting up around the edge of the table, one hand breadth high, which is between 3 and 4 inches, around the table, all the way around. That's one explanation. The other opinion is that the miskeres went beneath the table, connecting the legs of the table. All four legs were connected by this miskeres, which ran under the, what are we going to call this? The
tabletop.
Okay, under the tabletop, there was this miskeres, this border around it. So it didn't jut up above the tabletop, rather it was beneath the tabletop. These are two opinions in the Gemara.
If it's beneath, you wouldn't see it.
Well, you would see it. There was no tablecloth.
If it's beneath, what about the crown?
Right. So it's unclear to me exactly where that crown went if the thing was beneath. The picture they draw over here, it's hard to see.
You can't tell which is which.
Yeah, it's hard to see what they did exactly.
Could the crown be facing down?
It's possible. Most crowns don't do that.
No,
you would think that either way the crown is going to jut up above the rim of the table. Just that if the miskeres does that already, if the border does that already, then the crown will be even above that. Very slightly, yeah.
No one was alive who had seen this in the second Beit.
Yeah, so sometimes you have an eyewitness report in the Mishnah. The sages of the Mishnah primarily lived after the destruction of the Second Temple. There were some that lived during the Second Temple. Hillel and Shammai, the original Hillel and Shammai, lived 100 years before the destruction of the Second Temple. So they're obviously eyewitness reports.
Reporters.
Rabbi Akiva, he was not yet the great sage until after the destruction. He became the great sage that he was only after the temple was destroyed. So we do have some eyewitness accounts, but very often the Mishnah is discussing something about the Second Temple 100 or 200 years after it was destroyed. So then finding a survivor is difficult. So at the time when it was, when they're discussing that particular topic, it depends when that debate happened. This debate obviously took place after the temple was destroyed. So we continue. Pasuk Chavah, verse 26. V'asisalo arba tabos zahav, you shall make for it, for the table, four rings of gold. V'nasatas tabos, you shall place those rings al arba ha-peos, on the four corners, Asherli Abra Raglav, there to the four legs of the table. So the four rings are affixed to the legs of the table. Lumas Hamisgeret Tiena Tabos, the rings should be corresponding to the Misgeres, to the border. Whatever, it's hard to understand exactly what that means, since the border went all the way around. Livatim Livadim, those rings will be housing for the poles, la'aseis ha'shulchan, to carry the table, which means you're going to slip the poles into those rings to carry the table when they travel through the wilderness. V'aseis ha'sabadim atzei shitim, you shall make those poles out of shitim wood. V'tzipisa osam zahav, you shall plate them with gold. V'nisa v'ames ha'shulchan, and the table will be carried via those poles. And finally, this is the second to last verse about the table. Now we have a description of all the other components of the table. Because the table, so far we've discussed the what we call a table, which is a table top and four legs, with the addition of a border or a molding, and the addition of a crown, and the addition of rings, then you have poles that will carry the table. But we have not had any description of what the table is for, and what will be on top of the table to hold, as we know, the lechem upon the showbread. So the Torah tells us, V'asisa ki'arosav, v'chaposav, uksosav, u'minakiosav. That's four different things. Ki'arosav, I'm going to use the English over here.
Dishes.
It's dishes. Chaposav, it's spoons. Ksosav, it's shelving tubes, umirakiosav, and its pillars, asheyusach bahin, with which it will be covered. All those items, zahav tohar tasel, some should be made out of pure gold. So what are these four items? As always, we're going to have somewhat of a debate, but everybody agrees which four items we're talking about over here. The question is which words mean which, but the dishes were actually pans with which to bake the lechem apanim, with which to bake the showbread. The showbread, the lechem apanim, had a very specific shape. We'll talk about that in a moment. So in order to bake them into that shape, that you had a mold, and the dough was actually put in that mold in order to make it that particular shape. So that is what the ka'aros, the dishes, are. Now, they were baked in a metal dish, of course, and they were transferred, I believe, to a gold dish. I'm not sure if Rashi mentions it over here or not. Yeah, okay, doesn't discuss it over here. But anyway, you have this mold in which the dough was baked, and then we have chaposav, the spoons. So the spoons, it's hard to call them a spoon. They were a container, a small container, to hold the spices. That there were spices placed in the kapos, in these spoons, on the table. We'll talk about those spices in a moment. And the ksosav u'menachiosav, which are translated as shelving tubes and pillars. So in order to hold the showbread, you had these long poles that went from the floor up to significantly higher than the table, and there were notches in each of the poles. The notches corresponded to each other. And then you had, how do they translate it here? They translated it as pillars. Well, then you had shelving tubes. The shelving tubes were laid horizontally. The pillars, of course, were vertical. And then the shelving tubes were laid horizontally, fitting into the notches of the pillars. And the showbread was placed on those shelving tubes. So if they do have a picture over here. Of course, a picture is deceiving because there are different opinions for exactly what it looked like, but this is one opinion. And we'll discuss exactly what it was in a moment. But let's finish the last verse. And you shall place from the table lechem panim, which is showbread, but the literal translation is bread. What's panim? Faces, or face. Face bread in front of me. This is in front of Hashem, in front of God, tamid, constantly. There has to be this showbread, this face bread, all the time on the table. So the table, you had 12 loaves of the showbread that had to be on the table, which means that you had to have a place for 12 different loaves. The Torah, not over here, the Torah in Parshas Emor, which actually is this coming Shabbos, is this coming week's Parsha, at the end of the Parsha, says that you have to have the 12 loaves stacked in piles of six. Two, I guess we'll call them piles, of six each. Now, they didn't lay the showbread one on top of the other. What they did is they had the bottom two resting on the table, then the next layer rested on some of these shelving tubes. Then more shelving tubes, and more, stacked until you had six one on top of the other on both piles. The shelving tubes, as Rashi explains, he says, you should picture a reed. Now, we wouldn't say reed because we're not familiar with reeds. We don't live in an area where reeds grow all over the place. But what we can picture is bamboo, even though we don't generally grow bamboo, but most of us are familiar with what it looks like anyway. I happen to grow up in a house which had bamboo growing in the backyard, but that was in Philadelphia. But most people are familiar with bamboo from a sukkah, because a lot of people use bamboo for schach. So take a hollow bamboo rod and cut it in half lengthwise. So you have a half circle, a very long half circle pole. That's what these shelving tubes look like. They were made out of gold, but they were half circle, and that way the air could get through. As she says, in order to keep the air moving
So it didn't. You didn't have the bread lying on this shelf, which the bottom would get whatever wouldn't look nice or something wouldn't. I guess it would get moldy or whatever it is. So you had these half circle tubes. Rashi explains that each layer had three of these shelving tubes, so that you had on each stack in the bottom loaf was on the table. Then came three of these tubes, and another loaf on top of that. Then three more, another on top of that, three more, etc. And so you got to the top, the bottom, the very top one only had two shelving tubes. That's what Rashi explains. So those tubes, as we said, fit into the notches of the pillars. Now the bread, we've mentioned this before, but it's always worth saying it again because it's so confusing because everybody says bread. It wasn't bread. It was matzah. There was no bread in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple except for two items. Other than two items, everything else was matzah. Even when, no matter where, whenever you see the term lechem, which we translate as bread, lechem doesn't mean bread, literally. Lechem means a baked item of water and flour, which could either be matzah or it could be bread, depending on how you make it. In the Beis HaMikdash, you always had to have matzah. You weren't allowed to have bread. It was Pesach all year round in the Beis HaMikdash, except for two items. There were only two items that were made as bread. Those two items...
On
Shavuos, not the Omer was also matzah. Okay. On Shavuos, there was a special sacrifice that was brought, and with that sacrifice were two loaves of actual bread. That was a special dispensation for the holiday of Shavuos only. And
mincha?
No, a regular mincha was made of matzah.
Wasn't it oil?
There was also oil. Yes. Right. Okay, so we'll talk about that in a moment. But the only other thing that was made into bread that was allowed to rise was when you brought a Thanksgiving offering, a todah, you brought 40 loaves, of which 30 were matzah, 10 were bread. Those are the only two times that you could have actual bread in the Beis HaMikdash. Other than that, it was always matzah, including the lechem upon it, including the showbread. Yeah.
The matzah they had, though, for the showbread, wasn't that soft?
Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about. Okay, so now when we think of matzah, especially having just dealt with Pesach,
yeah.
So we think of this real crumbly stuff that if you get it shipped to you, you when you open the box, you open it very tenderly and just hope that they remain whole in the shipment, right? So that's true. That's the way we bake matzah today. And the reason we bake matzah that way today is because we are afraid that if we don't do it that way, that there will be some of it that will rise. Remember that with Pesach, you don't need a whole loaf of bread for it to be a problem. Even if only a little bit of it rises, it's a problem. So because we are unsure how to bake something that isn't hard and crumbly like that, without it becoming technically, legally, having the term bread, that's why we make it hard and crumbly, to keep it from that, to stay away from the problem. But really, if you just follow the exact letter of the law, you can make matzah that has some thickness to it. And the closest thing I can think of is like a pita. Right. Now, pita is bread. No one should eat pita on Pesach. That's a problem too. Even matzah could be chametz. Even matzah, if you wait more than 18 minutes in your processing of the matzah, that can also become a problem on Pesach. But technically, if you're careful to make it right, you could make a matzah that has some thickness to it and is more like pita or spongy. And some svardim still make matzah that way. They still have a tradition, a mesorah, in their families, and they make matzah that way. Ashkenazim do not have that mesorah. We've lost it, and we don't do it anymore. But we know that technically it could be done, and that's certainly the way the Lechem Apanim was made. Mirza Hashem, when the third temple is built, then we go back and we have the way everything was meant to be, we will have that type of matzah. Again, I imagine that when that happens, we'll be able to eat that on Pesach too.
once it gets reinstituted and we all know how to make it. So the lechem hapanim, although it was matzah, when I say matzah, I mean it was unleavened bread, but it was not hard and crumbly. It did have some thickness to it. I don't know exactly what the consistency was, but it did have some thickness to it. And the shape of the lechem hapanim was sort of like a U. It was kind of like that. It was a half, not a circle, but it was a flat bottom, and then it came up on the sides, and it was shaped like a U.
Is that like a tortilla, maybe?
Maybe, but it wasn't hard and crumbly.
The tortillas
aren't, but then they don't have a shape, so it had to be some kind of more of a firm shape to it. This is why you needed a mold to bake it, and then it was placed on the table, and it was slid into those pieces. It was slid right on, and that's where they remained for how long?
A week.
For a little over a week. They were baked on a Friday. They were put into the table on Shabbos, and they remained there to the next Shabbos. So they were there for 8 days, and then on the next Shabbos, the new set of lechem hapanim, the new loaves, the next 12 loaves, which were baked on the previous Friday, the day before, they replaced the ones that were 8 days old. The ones that were 8 days old were eaten then on Shabbos by the Kohanim, and the same process repeated itself every Shabbos, so that the bread remained on the table for 8 days. This was one of the
miracles,
one of the constant miracles. We know there were several constant miracles, consistent miracles in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, as well as in the Mishkan and the tabernacle. And one of them was that the lechem hapanim, the showbread, remained fresh for 8 days every single week. It tasted just like it was fresh out of the oven when they ate it on Shabbos. It was apparently very, very tasty. The Kohanim, it was so good that the Kohanim used to try to get as much as they could of it, and it became somewhat of a... It got to a point where those who were of higher character would not eat any of it, because it became, you know, there was jostling and trying to get more of it. So the Kohanim who were of a finer quality midos, they would hang back and they wouldn't have any. Just say, you know, I'm not going to do it. But apparently it tasted very good, and even though it was 8 days, that was one of the constant miracles of the Beis HaMikdash.
Did it also stay warm?
It seems that way. I think I remember that it was warm too.
But why was it so good? It was only flour and water.
Well, even flour and water.
It was not the Beis HaMikdash.
Anyway, even flour and water, if it comes out of the oven fresh, it
I
is.
Know.
Now, the spices which were put in these spoons on the table. That's also mentioned explicitly in Parsha Samar, this coming week's Parsha. It mentions how you have to have two stacks of six. That you also have these two spoons, each full of spices. The rule is in the Beis HaMikdash that everything, no matter what, any offering, whether it is an animal or a bird, or if it's a meal offering, whatever is offered in the Beis HaMikdash, something of it has to go to the altar, either burned or poured, as in libations, wine, but something has to go to the altar. There's nothing that's ever brought in the temple that is only consumed by a human being and not given at all to the altar. Everything has some element. Now, normally with a meal offering, the meal offering, part of it is removed, usually it's a small part, a handful, which is burned, and the rest of it is eaten. With an animal, some of the fats, the non-kosher fats of the animal, are burned, and the rest of the animal is eaten. We do have some offerings where the entire animal is burned, but no matter what, even the parts, even the types of offerings where the item is consumed, part of it is burned. As I mentioned before, the Thanksgiving offering that has 40 loaves, well, of the 40 loaves, four of them end up being burned. the other 36 are eaten. So there's always something. With the lechem ha'panim, with the showbread, all 12 loaves were completely consumed by the Kohanim. None of it was burned. So then what element is burned, is put on the altar, that is on the table? That is where these spices come in. The spices, the bazichin that held these spoons, that held the spices, that's what was burned on the altar. And the bread, or the whatever you want to call it, bread or matzah, was eaten by the Kohanim. So that's the purpose of these bazichim, of these spoons that held the spices, because they would get burned on the altar when it was time to eat the bread. So we have this table, and we have the bread. It says that the lechem ha'panim, in the last verse here, it says that the lechem ha'panim needs to be on the table constantly. It should be lefanai, before me, tamid, constantly. Now the word tamid, constantly, there, it does not have to mean 24/7. We know it doesn't have to mean 24/7 because we know there is a carbon, there's a sacrifice called the carbon hatamid, the constant sacrifice. Now that doesn't mean that for 24/7 you are sacrificing animals. What that means is that there was a sacrifice that was brought daily, every day without fail. And that sacrifice is called the tamid because it's consistent. It's every single day. And that's called tamid, constant. So constant doesn't have to mean every single second, but it means that there is some consistency to it. Over here, what does the word tamid mean? We have another place where it says the word tamid, which is regarding the menorah, which that's the next item which we'll do, Mirz Hashem, next week. The menorah has the ner tamid. It has a fire that's burning all the time. As a remembrance for that, most shuls have a ner tamid, as we do over here. I don't know if you can see it from here. But there is a ner tamid, as most shuls have in the front. The constantly burning, usually it's electricity, sometimes it's gas, but there's some sort of thing that's constantly burning as a ner tamid. But the ner tamid of the menorah did not burn constantly. There was a miracle that it stayed lit all for 24 hours, but they would extinguish it and relight it. So it wasn't that it burned forever. It was extinguished and relit. So tamid doesn't have to mean 24/7. Here, with the showbread, again, there is a debate exactly what it means, tamid. Everybody agrees that the bread stayed on the table all week. But did you have to have the bread on the table at every single moment? What's the difference whether you have to have it every single moment or not? The question is, how did you make the exchange from the old bread to the new bread? So, if you say that tamid doesn't mean every single second, okay, so they took off the old bread and then they put in the new bread. Not a big deal. But if you say that tamid means, in this context, means 24/7 every single second, and there are those who say this, then what they did is they slid out the old bread as they were sliding in the new bread, and one replaced the other. And there was never a moment that the Shulchan was without its bread. It was constantly tamid. There was constantly going to be bread on that table from the time it was constructed until the Mishkan was no longer used. It was the Beis HaMikdash that was used, but the table always had it. Even when they traveled, the lechem ha'panim remained on the table, even when they traveled. Now, we already mentioned that this crown represents the crown of Malchus, of royalty. And that the Shulchan, which clearly indicates Olam, the Olam Hazeh, that indicates materialism, is you have the crown of royalty, and the king is in control of the material resources of the country. When we talk about three crowns, and we say this, the crown of Torah, and the crown of Kuhuna, of the priesthood, and the crown of Malchus, of royalty, so we know what Torah is. And we know why there's a crown of Torah, that is the sage that studies the Torah and knows the Torah. It is purely an intellectual pursuit that one who has studied it thoroughly has a crown of having mastered the Torah. The crown of kahuna, of the priesthood, so you have the kohanim who are charged with the responsibility of maintaining the temple and maintaining the service of the temple. And when they do it properly, so they wear a crown, I'm talking here about a figurative crown, of the ones who are in charge of that particular endeavor. The crown of royalty, now we're used to that more than the other two because we know the kings wear crowns. So a crown is something that goes on a person's head which shows some sort of elevated status. The crown of royalty for us, so you have this person that is in charge of the material resources of the country and is responsible for the material resources of the country. Why does that have a place in the Beis HaMikdash? Meaning, I understand why there would be a crown of priesthood, of kuhuna, in the temple. That makes a lot of sense. That's where the Kohanim practice their responsibility. That's where you would have something that represents them in the Beis HaMikdash. The crown of Torah I can also understand, since the Torah is essentially a spiritual item, I can understand it belongs over there. Why would there be an item that represents physicality and the authority over the physicality, the materialism of the country, why would that belong in the temple?
Well, are we supposed to be reminded that Hashem is
okay,
like a Yom Kippur?
Okay, so
Hashem, our king.
Okay, so you say that we're reminded that Hashem is really the one providing all of the material benefits that we have. Perfect. So the Mishnah tells us in Pirkei Avos, and I think of the Fathers, the Mishnah tells us, Imein kemach ein Torah, imein Torah ein kemach. Without kemach, without flour, literally flour, F-L-O-U-R, without food, there is no Torah. Without Torah, there is no flour, there is no food. Which means that without food, without flour, you cannot have Torah, because we are physical beings, as spiritual as we want to be, but we are physical beings. We are commanded by the Torah itself to take care of our physical bodies, our health, because why do we need to take care of our physical bodies? Because Hashem wants us to serve Him, and He put us in a physical world with a physical body, and the mitzvos are performed with our physical bodies. If we don't take care of ourselves, God forbid, then we are unable to serve. So He wants us to take care of ourselves, and it is a mitzvah for persons to take care of themselves, make sure that they are healthy. If one does not do so, and one does not eat, which is the most basic form of taking care of oneself, you got to eat. So if one doesn't do so, it's impossible for a person to perform the Torah. And conversely, if one does not perform the Torah, then there is also no food. What does that mean? That means the food has no meaning. What's the point of making my body a wonderful, healthy body if I'm not doing anything constructive with this body? I can work out and make myself absolutely physically fit, and then what? Is that the purpose of life, to be physically fit? That's not the purpose of life. The purpose of life is to serve Hashem properly. So I've got to give myself a purpose other than just making my body what it should be. So they work in tandem with each other. In the Beis HaMikdash, you have the representation of Torah. You have the representation of service of Hashem, that's the Kohanim. But you also have the representation of Malchus, of royalty, which is the authority over the materialism of the country, which is just as critical as the other two components. It's three. It's a stool that stands on three legs. You need all three. Without the third component, without any of the three components, the stool will fall apart. It will tip over. You need this component as much as you need the other two components. They're not. It's not a secondary issue. It is just as important, and the table represents it. But we can learn from the table a lot about dealing with our physical drives, because we have physical drives. We're human beings. That physical drive is much more powerful than our spiritual drive. What I mean to say is this. Most people, if they have no higher purpose in their lives, if their lives are only about their physical bodies, trying to satiate their drives, trying to get as much pleasure out of the world as possible, most people will feel empty. They'll have an empty feeling. And it's difficult to deal with that empty feeling. That empty feeling leads to depression, and it leads to people doing things. That empty feeling is something that people try to fulfill. Now, if a person is not trying to fulfill it in a way that is in a lofty way, they will fulfill it by crawling inside of a bottle or drugs or whatever it is. People will find ways to escape that feeling of emptiness. And we see it all around us all the time. Some people will seek to feel fulfilled by actually having a higher purpose. And that higher purpose could be a humanitarian purpose. It could be some sort of a cerebral goal in study of some sort of in some area. And it could be some sort of a meditation. Whatever it is, people have ways of trying to fill that need. And we, of course, understand that the way that we deal with that, which is was put there on purpose by Hashem, is to serve Hashem. That's our higher purpose. And to perform the mitzvahs of the Torah. But that drive, which is really a spiritual drive, it's the need to feel that we're doing something of a higher purpose. That drive is in every single one of us, but it is far more subtle than our physical drives. Because that drive, the drive for spirituality, for fulfillment, that can be ignored for a good long time without getting depressed, without a person can go and have a good time in life for a long time before they turn around and feel very, very empty. But if you don't eat for a few hours, you feel hungry. That's all it takes, is a few hours. And even if you're not hungry, but you pass by a good restaurant or bakery or an ice cream store, all of a sudden you're hungry again. But you just ate dinner, right? Because our physical drives are much more powerful than our spiritual drive. And therefore, the physical drive needs to be dealt with. It can't be taken for granted. It has to be dealt with properly. And we learn from the table how to deal with it properly. Let's look very carefully at these verses. Go back to the beginning, which is, again, on page 448. It starts with Chof Gimel 23. So, we talk about building this table. And the table follows the same pattern as the other ones. It tells you the dimensions. It's made of wood. It's plated with gold. Fine. Starting in Pasuk Chaf Hey, we have a curiosity. You shall make a misgeres. You shall make this, again, they call it, what, a molding? Okay. They call it a molding or a border around this table. And it's a tefach high. It's a handrest. It either goes right above the table or right below the table. And you're going to put the crown where? You're going to put the crown on the misgeres, on this border, on this molding. Let's read that verse. Chafei 25. You shall make for it a... I'm going to call it a misgeres. I'm going to use that word, which again means border or molding. You shall make for it a misgeres. Tofach saviv, which is a tefach all around it, a handbreadth. And you shall make that aforementioned crown on the misgeres. It should go on this border. Then the next verse tells us that you should make these rings for the poles. That, again, is consistent with the other utensils of the Mishkan. And then, Pasuk Chaf Zayin 27, you know where the rings go? Li'umas ha-misgeres. Corresponding to the misgeres, to this molding, to this border, that's where the rings should go. And as I mentioned when I read it, it's hard to understand what that means, because the misgeres goes all around the table. So exactly what it means, li'umas ha-misgeres, it sounds like right near the misgeres. That's where the rings should go. In the picture, that's the way they draw it, that it's kind of near the misgeres. Unclear exactly what that means. But the misgeres is mentioned three times in the discussion here of this table. And the misgeres is a curiosity. Let's take the opinion that the miskeres was above the rim of the tabletop. That's a very cumbersome table. Would you have a dining room table or a kitchen table with a rim that jutted out above the edge of the tabletop? Makes it extremely uncomfortable to deal with such a table. Not the way you would normally construct a table. It's a funny way to do things. And so that's why they had, that explains the crown. The crown was a little thing that did jut up.
Yeah.
On that, right? But here you have this handbreadth thing in addition to that, that goes around the table. Now if it was below the table, below the table top, so then it makes a little bit more sense, at least physically we can see a table like that. But even so, what's its purpose? What's the purpose of this misgeres? What does it do? Why is it there? The rings are to hold the poles to carry the table. The pillars and the shelving
tubes,
I was going to say units, are there to hold the bread. And the spoons are there to hold the spices. And the crown is there to represent royalty. But what is this border thing doing here? So the within the construction of the table, there is this misgeres, which has the word, it comes, the root of it is sagur, which means closed, as in closing a door. And the Torah is telling us that that which represents materialism needs to have a border around it. Because if you don't limit materialism, it will consume you. You're not going to consume it. It will consume you. A person will, as the Gemara says, Yesh lo mana rotza masayim. If he has 100, he wants 200. A person's appetite is never satiated for physical items. It will go on forever and ever and ever until a person is no longer in this world. But as long as a person is in this world, a person's physical appetite for anything physical can be insatiable. If we don't deliberately limit ourselves, if we don't somehow put a misgeres, some sort of a boundary all around the table, which is a message, which is, it's not just good food, but food is necessary. You gotta have food. You gotta have it. And not only do you have to have it, it can taste great. And it's wonderful. But if you don't have some way of creating a boundary, it will consume you. And food is only a representation of all physical drives. Just food is the one that's the most pervasive. Everybody needs food. From an infant to an old person, makes no difference. Everybody, a human being, needs food to survive. It's the most basic of all physical drives. It's a good thing we get hungry. If, God forbid, we didn't get hungry, we'd forget to eat. And God forbid, we wouldn't be healthy. We'd hurt ourselves. So hunger is a good thing. That's what keeps us eating, which is what is necessary. But if we don't watch it, then it will be out of control. And so the message here is you've got to have a misgeres. Now anybody who is trying to deal with a diet or anything like that understands this. We understand it with food all the time. But there, the reason people diet, why do people diet? People diet either because of their physical appearance or their physical health. Those are the two reasons that people generally diet. It's either because they want to look different or they want to feel different, or they're afraid for their health. Those are the two reasons that people generally diet. The Torah is not saying that. Those are good reasons, but the Torah is not saying that. The Torah is saying even if you look great, and even if no doctor is telling you to be careful of how much food you consume or what types of food you consume, even though that's not an issue, somehow they create this miracle food that doesn't make you gain weight and it doesn't cause any kind of health issue, and you could eat it all you want, just keep on eating, it's no problem. You still have to limit what you're eating, because otherwise that will become your life. Your life will become eating, or whatever drive you plug in to that, to, you know, for physical drives, whichever one it is, that will become your life. And it can't become your life. At the end of the day, all physical drives are meant to be a means to an end, not an end in and of itself. This message is so hard for us because we live in a society where physical drives are the end-all and be-all of life. That is what it is. There is nothing more important to people living in our society, not everybody, but I'm generalizing here, but most people living in our society, than their physical drives. And we have to understand, we have to know that physical drives are important, but they are a means to an end, and they have to be limited.
They didn't have to crave for more.
But right. They could have. And you can, the thing about a physical drive is that you can make it stronger than it is. A person who doesn't have a particular drive, but you can make it that way. You find in the world today, it's an amazing thing. You find today that people who have gotten past, we'll call it the party years, and they've raised their kids, and they're in a stage of life where they don't have anything that's really pressing on them. They're financially stable, and they're not raising small children anymore. There's no mountain to conquer. They feel empty, and they don't know what to do with themselves. And very often, people like that will seek to restart, to try to get their physical drives to become more active. Why are they doing that? Because they don't know what else to do with themselves. They're feeling like, what am I supposed to do now? So they will deliberately try to get their physical drives to become more powerful. We know that the opposite is really the way it's supposed to be. That as a person ages, the reason why the physical drives diminish is because as we age, we're supposed to become more and more connected to Hashem. And that we don't need those physical drives as much anymore, and we are becoming more and more connected to the spiritual, to Hashem, so that at the end, when we actually die, everybody eventually dies, that death, which is ultimately the separation of the soul from the body, our spiritual selves from our physical selves, and the spiritual side is going to go to Hashem, physical side will go into the ground until the resurrection of the dead, but for that interim period, it shouldn't be such a traumatic experience to leave the body behind. See, that's the thing. When we die, we shouldn't be so connected to the physical world. It's so important to be physical. At that point, okay, so my physical body has done its job. I'm going to leave it here for the time being. I'm going to go upstairs. Eventually, Hashem is going to put me back with my physical body. That's for the world to come. But it shouldn't be a terribly traumatic experience to leave my body behind, because at that age, my body's done its thing, and it's time to leave it behind. That's what it should be. That's the ultimate picture. And we see in the world around us that for many people, they have a very, very hard time with that. It's very, very difficult to envision a life where the physical body isn't the central focus of my life. And the Shulchan is teaching us otherwise. You've got to have a boundary. There's got to be a miskeres. Okay, so we will pause here.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.